That's one of the most heartbreaking stories I've heard. And yeah, like I said, I think just if you like mapped the way that I was processing that story, and it was just not where I thought it was going to go at all. And that's shitty.
Cornerstone memory is an anchoring moment that, if left unprocessed, can harden into a core belief.
People would say, oh, you need to just let it go and move on and forget about it. And, you know, that never felt right to me. It was Valentine's Day, and my mom took me to Walmart, and we bought one of those, like, you know, those big perforated sheets of Valentine's cards that are like eight on a page. And, and I noticed that the one that I had given to this, you know, young girl who I had what I guess was the beginnings of a crush on, you know, she had returned the card that I had given her, and I opened it and looked at it. And of course, on the front, it said, Happy Valentine's Day, I love you too. And on the back, she had written, I remember like getting that card and feeling so much, well, confusion.
Hi there, lovers. This episode is going to be pretty profound. So we're going to be talking about cornerstone memories, which in essence are experiences that can shape the way that we experience life. But we're going to hyper-focus on this podcast, of course, on the ways that these memories can shape the way that we experience love. So a cornerstone memory is an anchoring moment that, if left unprocessed, can harden into a core belief. You believe it's magic. Now, sometimes for some people, this can be a positive thing. For example, having the cornerstone memory of being on the stairs and overhearing your parents talk about you in the kitchen, and you hear them say things like, oh my gosh, just so amazing. Can you believe that we brought this remarkable human into the world? And they're just gushing and glowing about you. Not because you did anything particularly fantastic, but just because they acknowledge that you are a lovely human being worthy of being loved. And that's the core belief that you move forward in the world with. But sadly, for a lot of people, their cornerstone memory is not so positive. In fact, often they're quite traumatic.
We're in the laundry room that connects to the garage, seeing the younger version of myself be taught to not rely on people. And she's taught that like people will walk away.
And this one little girl, she said, I don't like you, no one likes you. And they're just too, what did she say? No one wants to say it, but I'm just nice enough to actually tell you.
Going to my dad at his apartment and like asking for a hug and him being just like, no, stop being annoying, like you're fine.
And that turns into a core belief that is a heinous lie that can wreak havoc on our love lives. Some people for a lifetime, and hopefully for some of us, until we are able to press the stop button and reprocess it. So this episode is a conversation that I had with actor Andre Holland, if you don't know. Andre is an esteemed performer who is definitely a face you recognize. And if you don't, hopefully you'll go and see Love Brooklyn in theaters right now. He is the leading man in that. And hopefully that will be an incredible introduction for you. I'm fortunate enough to have seen the film and fallen in love with it. And I love the fact that I got to have a in-depth conversation with Andre after that, which provided a whole new meaning to his performance in it. So Andre's going to be talking about a cornerstone memory that he experienced and how today he has been showing up for himself as himself to heal from it. There was a line from the movie that I want to chew on with you. When you can't hold in your hands the things that you love the most, you take the memories.
Mm-hmm. And it was that line was a late addition. So part of what we were trying to figure out is, you know, there's this motif in the movie about this painting that they go and see at the gallery, Sodom, the burning of Sodom, which was a Henry Ossawa Tanner painting. And yeah, this idea of like not looking back and you know, when the ground is underneath you is shifting and things are changing, what can you bring with you? And like those memories are the things that one can always hold despite the circumstance. But I'm curious to know what resonated with you. What came up for you in that?
I am a very big proponent, you know, like with life lessons or lessons that I've learned through love, even if the person isn't mine anymore, I don't know the person anymore, that experience is still mine to hold and continue to impact me in different ways. So I loved it because I felt like it was saying, like, look, like there are a lot of things in life that we don't get to take with us, but
we do get to have our memories. And we do get to allow those to shape us. We do get to talk about them still. We do get to reflect on them still.
That's beautiful, beautifully said. And I can feel that. I relate to that too. And I used to, I don't know if you ever done this, but I used to try and almost like punish myself for wanting to hold on to those memories. Do you know what I mean? Like I would sometimes feel like
yes.
people would say, oh, you need to just let it go and move on and forget about it and, you know, don't look back. But that never felt right to me. Over time, I think what I've learned or am learning is how to like make peace with those memories and allow them to be a part of my life without fixating or allowing them to sort of dictate what the future is going to look like. But yeah, I agree with you. It's nice to hold on to them sometimes.
And with that being said, what the goal is of our time together is to try to get a gem of wisdom from you, because I believe everybody is an intimacy expert. We're all born to love, we're super bonders, and it's our superpower. And there is something that you've experienced in your intimate life that has shaped the way that you think of intimacy going forward. So I'd love to learn what that lesson is and how you came to learn it.
Well, there's so many lessons I can think of, but one that comes to mind, and one that I think is really related to the movie and to the character I play in the movie, is, you know, there were times in my life where I felt like, both like professionally, also interpersonally, where I felt like I had to always be earning the affection or the time, you know, or the love of another person. And that showed up in my, you know, romantic relationships. And it often presented as me like overdoing it, you know, like overperforming and you know, trying to make everything okay and always concerned about like, well, what are you feeling? What's going on with you? And trying to like, you know, in a somewhat like what can be seen as like a manipulative way, I think trying to like get inside of the other person's experience so that I can like control the experience that we're having together, which really was a way I think of me trying to make myself feel safe in the relationship. And what I think that did was it like foreclosed on the opportunity of like really getting to know a person and of really allowing myself to be my full self in the presence of another. And when I think back on it, you know, through like, you know, obviously therapy and like thinking through these things, there are some very like formative experiences that I had when I was quite young that I think taught me that that who I was like isn't enough somehow, and that I had to be some other version of myself in order to be loved and to be, you know, cared for. When I was very young, I remember one of my first little crushes when I was a kid was on this girl in my fourth grade class, and it was Valentine's Day, and I remember our teacher had given us this assignment to go, you know, and get Valentine's cards and bring them in for our classmates. And so my mom took me to Walmart and we bought one of those, like, you know, those big perforated sheets of Valentine's cards that are like eight on a page. And,
yes.
You know, and it said, you know, happy Valentine's Day, I love you, to blank, from blank, and you write the name in. Anyway, we did that. And I remember, you know, at the beginning of the class, we all like filled out our cards and passed them out to our classmates. And at the end of the day, we got to open our cards and, you know, see what our classmates said about us. And I noticed that the one that I had given to this, you know, young girl who I had what I guess was the beginnings of a crush on, you know, although it was fourth grade, and so I don't really know that I even knew what that meant. But, you know, I felt an affection for her. And she had returned the card that I had given her, and I opened it and looked at it. And of course, on the front, it said, happy Valentine's Day, I love you too. Her name, from Andre. And on the back, she had written, I hate you. I guess you can, yeah. And I remember like getting that card and feeling so much, well, confusion. But then I think what came in was this sense of shame. Like, I felt, man, there must be, I don't know what that means exactly, but I know that that means there must be something wrong with me, or else I've done something so wrong, you know, by expressing this, that I deserve some kind of punishment. And I think for a long time. You know, I kept that card. I like hid it in my little sock drawer and I kept it with me for a long time. And I think in a lot of ways that, that experience is one that I've kind of been trying to avoid happening again in relationships. So what that thing created is this sense of like, I gotta be perfect. You know, like I can't let them see anything wrong with me. Like I gotta have the right answer all the time. I gotta always know what they're feeling so that I, you know, if there's some kind of card coming for me, I need to know so I can brace myself for it, you know? And I think it really was always, it created the sense of like always trying to like be my best for other people instead of just being myself. And I think that in a way, Roger's experience in this movie is not unlike that, in the sense that I feel like his issue is that he's not really been able to like sit with himself, you know? Like on the one hand, you could look at the movie and say, oh, it's a movie about a guy who's caught in his love triangle and trying to figure out who he wants to be with, and they're trying to figure out whether they want to be with him. And that's all, that is a part of the story. But I think underneath that is a guy who's like, for whatever reason, not able to like be alone in a room with himself and with his own thoughts and be at peace. And so to avoid that, he goes on these night bike rides, he goes out with this person and then that person and then another person, and he, you know, obsesses over work. He does all these things to avoid, I think, sitting with himself, you know? And it's not until the very end of the movie that he begins that process, you know? He doesn't arrive at a place, but like we see him go. He says at the end, and I'm gonna completely spoil it for you. He says at the end, you know, he says, I've been working on some things, finishing some things. And I think the things he's been working on is his relationship with himself. So yeah, I think I've had to learn how to heal the relationship that I have like with myself. Yeah, and not doing that earlier in my life, I think, caused chaos in some of my romantic relationships.
Andre, if I could have mapped my internal process of listening to that story, like it would have looked like a heartbeat, because it was making me cry even reflecting on the idea of Valentine's Day and giving a card to everybody. Like how beautiful it is that now it's, as you get older, it becomes something to gatekeep. It becomes something performative. Not just are you loved, but how much are you loved? Like what value of gift do you get that illustrates how much your partner values you? And that becomes like a public display. And then people who don't get anything. And so I was reflecting on being younger and everybody getting a Valentine's Day card indiscriminately and how beautiful it is. Because even when you said, you know, your mom bought those perforated cards and it said, you know, to so-and-so, I love you. And I was like, oh, that's a very, you know, that's a bold choice of words for a fourth grader to be issuing out to everybody. But then it's not. It's actually the most true words that you can issue out. So that was my first reflection piece. And then to hear the story of how that was twisted and manipulated, and how a beautiful earnest act that had a special meaning for this one particular person came back in a hate crime. Which, did you process it as such? Did you tell a teacher? Like, did you tell your mom? Like, how did you?
No, I didn't tell anybody. In fact, I think I had almost forgotten about it until, you know, maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. I had like locked it away somewhere, and then it came up as I was, dealing with like this situation, this like romantic relationship that I had been in a number of years ago. And it, in therapy, like emerged, and I was like, wow, I almost had forgotten about that.
Why?
I don't know, I guess, but why had I forgotten about it, you mean?
No, I mean, I guess there's not an answer to that question, but I don't know, that's such a terrible experience to go through, and to go through alone, and to not have any accountability to the other person. I understand like kind of the shame and the embarrassment, and I don't know, it just makes me feel so heartbroken. That makes me feel so heartbroken for little you. And I know that's not your goal with sharing that.
Thinking back on it, man, I actually feel heartbroken for her too, because that's something that somebody told her that. Somebody taught in her life taught her, you know, that that's how she's supposed to feel about people who look like me. So I feel like in a way I actually felt, you know, sorry for her, because and my heart really goes out to her because she was a child too, you know, and somebody in her life taught her that. It hurt me, but I think it hurt her too, you know. I'm not sharing the story to be like, oh, you know, poor me, and like I had this tough thing happen to me. It ain't that, but I think we all have had these kinds of, some kinds of like, you know, formative experiences like that we have to deal with and we have to heal. And if we don't, they will reveal themselves in relationships. Often, you know, it's a place where they come out. So I hope she's found a way to like heal whatever it is that that harmed her, you know, and taught her that too.
That's one of the most heartbreaking stories I've heard. And like I said, I think just if you like mapped the way that I was processing that story, and it was just not where I thought it was going to go at all. And that's shitty. When you were telling me about the base lesson, my brain was like lighting up into different paths of where I was assuming you were going with it. Because when you first talked about the kind of auditioning nature, and I think that's quite common, you know, in most of our lives, as our formative years, we're always auditioning, even, you know, grading. Grading is an auditioning of like how good you are. And there's like a measured remark on that. And there's a expected criteria you have to meet in order to get an A or a B or a C or a D. And so even our parents' approval oftentimes like is on a grading system. And a lot of us kind of grow up feeling like we have to perform humanity, masculinity, whatever it is, perform being a Black man in a certain way in order to get validation or a positive grade from people. So we just don't really live in a world that promotes authenticity and the idea that you're good enough as you are and that your uniqueness is valuable. So I guess I'm just kind of curious, let me ask a flat question here, is what did you mean by that? What did that look like in your adult years?
Thank you for asking that. And yeah, thank you for giving me the opportunity to say this too, because I feel like I want to share, I'd love to talk about that. Anyway, we could talk offline about it, but I feel like the people pleasing thing has definitely been a part of my experience. I think I can relate to what you said about wanting people to like you or to think that you're the one or they're the soulmate, even if you don't, you know yourself that that's not the person that you want. I've been in that before too, you know. I think, you know, also I grew up in the South in Alabama and in like an all Black neighborhood, but then I was often sent to schools that were, you know, predominantly white. Not always, but like, you know, much of my education was in those kinds of spaces. And so I think that kind of bred a sense of like, you know, I gotta prove myself, and also I gotta please everybody around me, you know what I mean, in order to like justify my being here, or you know, make my family feel like it's worth the sacrifice that they're making to send me to this space, or I gotta perform, or whatever. And I think that has definitely shown up, you know, in relationships. And it's exactly what you said, is it like stops the actual intimacy. It stops a person from really getting to see who you actually are. And that's something that even now I'm still like trying to figure out, how can I be more authentic? How can I be more honest in relationships? I have not always been that way, you know? And sometimes I think back on some of those relationships and I say, man, I really made a mess of that, you know? Not because I am a bad person, but because I, you know, wasn't willing to be my full self, you know, and give the other person the opportunity to decide whether or not they want to be in a relationship with me, which I think again comes back to that other thing of like, you know, unless you are comfortable being in relationship with yourself, it makes sense that a person would then seek to find comfort in relationship with another person at any cost. You dig what I mean? Like if I can't come home and be in this place by myself and be at ease or at peace, then I think it makes sense that, you know, the younger version of me will go out and seek that comfort in other places, at my own expense even. or at another person's expense. So yeah, the people pleaser thing is definitely a part of it. I think growing up in the South, that definitely bred a sense of like, man, I gotta earn it. I gotta prove myself. I gotta be the best. I gotta, you know, be what people want me to be or need me to be or think I should be. But I'm really excited about this part of my life where I think moving into a more mature place where I'm learning how to be more at ease with myself, you know, and more honest about who I am and what I want this like next chapter of my back nine, as they say, of my life to be.
Mm.
Yeah.
What came to mind is it's so much easier to be hated for who you're not than hated for who you are. If you're not yourself in relationships and you posture and pretend to be somebody else and you're rejected or you're disliked, well, it doesn't really hurt the same. I'm tempted to ask, because I want to kind of slot you into, I'm going to give you three male archetypes of kind of traditional, difficult, stereotypical men to date. So there's, and you can tell me if either one of these three buckets fits or if there's a different one I'm missing. There's the nice guy who's really not all that nice, but kind of pretends to be nice. Maybe he's the one who starts off as the friend and then, you know, looks for kind of covert ways to advance the relationship to something romantic. Then there is the fuckboy. And then lastly, there's what is now known as the performative male.
I gotta be honest. I feel like, I feel like I want to be fair, I think, to the younger version of me, who I actually have developed a lot of like empathy for.
Yes.
And not put him in any kind of a bucket. I think I've done that before, you know, and I think that's has like proven to be a way of like kind of harming myself and punishing myself. And what I'm really working on doing is being more compassionate, I think, with myself. And that includes who I am now and also who I used to be. And so I think who I was, who I have been, was the best version of myself that I was able to be at that time. Yeah, I don't think there's a bucket for that. I think I've always just tried to be the best Andre that I could be. And sometimes I've hit that mark and other times I've not. And going forward, I hope to be the kind of person who is, who's not performative in any kind of way, who's not manipulative, who's not, you know, gesturing at like a kind of care and concern that he doesn't really feel. I'd like to be a whole three-dimensional person who sometimes does the right thing and sometimes does the wrong thing and, you know, and is sometimes in a good mood and sometimes in a bad mood. I'd like to be a full person and I'd like to be, as you said, unconditionally concerned for by other people. I hope it's okay that I answered the question in
yes,
that way.
Yes, I love that answer. I'm also going to ask a follow-up, but I am also going to accept that answer because I do think it's massively important to side with yourself. And I refer to that as being, you know, when you've got a friend that you call up, even if you've done something, like you cussed out your boss at work, and then your friend's next question is going to be like, well, what did they do? Oh, well, they had it coming. It was a long time. And then they're going to side with you. They may not necessarily agree or validate the behavior, but they side with you. Again, kind of that unconditional positive regard. They see the best in you and they get why you made that decision. So I do love that you said that. I just kind of like to get a little context for what you mean. So even if it's not your personal story, but can you give me an example of a moment in which there was an opportunity to be authentic and like what was the choice and that you could have done and what was the path that you did take?
Thinking about one situation in particular where like, you know, there was a conflict and I was asked a very, I was asked like a clear question and I wasn't able to be authentic in that moment. I chose not to be authentic in that moment. And, you know, as a result, the relationship dissolved. And and I hope that I have an opportunity to make a different choice. I'm sure I will have an opportunity to make a different choice in the future, and I hope I make a better choice. I think, yeah, being authentic, being I think, again, I feel like it comes back to like this thing of trying to be a whole person and accepting, you know what I mean, that who we are is okay and is enough. Otherwise, I think that it's incredibly difficult to be authentic if you can't be authentic with yourself. And I think that's where, that was the area that I needed to work on and probably will continue to have to work on, you know.
I'm going to make a guess that's probably wrong, but I'm going to guess that at the end of the movie, Robert doesn't choose either and chooses to take time by himself. That could be wrong. But the question I have based on that is, do you think that in order to uncover who you actually are and be able to enter into any kind of dynamic with a sense of authenticity, you have to spend time by yourself first?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's, to me, that was one of the most compelling parts about the script, about the story, is that Roger learns that by the very, very end of the movie. You know, I think he learns that he has to be able to be with himself, to make peace with himself. And that process isn't, like him being at peace with himself isn't dependent on him performing or like writing the perfect piece or meeting the deadline or whatever, but just him alone in a room. Like that's where his work is, I think. And I think by the end of the movie, again, he doesn't get there, but we understand that he's gonna start that process. And that to me is kind of like revelatory, you know, especially for this movie, which is like a quiet, you know, moderately paced movie where it doesn't feel like a lot of big shifts are happening. But I think about it like, you know, like if you're on a ship and you turn the wheel this much, like you don't feel that impact right away, but you know, you go to sleep and wake up and then you end up in a completely different place, you know, because you've made this adjustment. And I think we see Roger and all these characters make these kind of like minor shifts that we understand will have like major impacts in their lives down the line.
Was there a particular moment where you turned your ship, or did you just wake up one day and realize, oh, I'm actually not on the way to China anymore?
No, I definitely turned it. I definitely turned it. And continue to turn. I think there was a moment in my life when I look back and I could see a clear pattern of like behavior on my part. And also, you know, yeah, there was this kind of like cyclical thing that was happening. It's like, man, why I keep ending up in the same spot? I think that's why I kind of resisted, like, why I'm really working on being kind to the younger part of me, the younger version of me, you know, because like he too was in process. It's just where he was at the time. And like, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, I'll probably look back on this moment and be, man, you didn't know what she was talking about. You should, you know. But I'm trying today to do the best that I can, you know, and to be as much myself as I can be.
How do you do that? How do you be yourself?
I think listening to yourself, you know, I think that we probably all have that voice in us that is like telling us who we are, you know? Having the courage, I think, to listen to that voice is a part of it. I think surrounding yourself with people who will hold you accountable and tell you the truth about what you're doing helps you to be yourself. For me, sometimes it's just like remembering where my feet are, you know, and just taking a breath and, you know, trying to stay locked in the present. That's one of the reasons I love acting, is because it's like a practice in which you have to constantly be coming back to the present moment, you know, like constantly. People think it's, oh, you just, you know, I'm, you know, playing make-believe or imagining being somebody else. And that is a part of it. But really what it is like a constant process of centering yourself within yourself over and over and over again. So in some ways, I feel most myself when I'm on stage. I'm doing a play right now on Broadway in New York. Yeah, every night I feel like I'm learning something new about myself. So much stuff about my life is coming up, even when I'm on stage, pretending to be somebody else. It's really me. I'm like confronting myself over and over again. And it's like it's your imagination, it's your memories that you're working from, you know? It's your, you know, you're pretending to be somebody else, but like your body doesn't know you're pretending. So the reactions that you're having in your body are real, you know, they're your own. So then there's a process of like, how do you take care of yourself after you've put yourself through this very difficult thing? So again, it's like learning how to care for yourself, learning how to allow yourself to breathe and to be present and to like have a thought, you know, to like just let yourself have a thought. also to trust yourself, to trust that like last night's performance ain't gonna be like tonight's performance, and that's okay. You know, and I think that's very much like a life thing, like trusting that each day can be different, each relationship can be different, each interaction will be different, you know, so long as you make space and allow for it to be and show up as yourself in an honest way.
We both can attest to how wonderful it is to be chosen. It is a wonderful feeling to be chosen. It is a wonderful feeling to be accepted. It is a wonderful feeling to have your Valentine's Day card returned. It's also a different kind of wonderful to choose yourself. Can you tell me a love story of a time that you chose yourself and how it felt?
That's a great question. Obviously, I love acting. I love what I do as a career. Also, it was something that kind of came naturally to me when I was young. So, you know, I've been doing it since I was probably 12 or 13 years old. Last year, I decided that I wanted to go back to school.
Can I be so nosy as to ask what you went back to school for?
Yeah, I went to divinity school. And I took a chance and I applied for this program that I had been eyeing for a long time. And to my surprise, I was accepted. And a lot of people in my life thought, well, why are you doing that? You know, it doesn't make any sense. Like, you're doing great. Your career is going great. You want to take this time to go do something else? And why do you want to do it? You know, what's the end game? And I didn't have an answer for like what the end game was. I still don't have an answer. But I knew it was something I wanted to do. And so I chose to do it. And in doing so, I think I chose myself. I listened to myself. And it proved to be a wonderful, wonderful experience. And I met some of the most incredible people I've ever met in my life. I learned things about myself that I didn't even know were there. And it has changed the trajectory, I think, of my life and of my career. And I love that, you know? So in a way, it is a kind of love story, you know? Because it's opened up all this possibility for me. And I'm so proud of myself for giving myself that gift, you know, for trusting that instinct that I had. And I'm so excited now to think about what might happen if I continue to really listen to that voice. My life could unfold in ways that, you know, are completely unexpected.
One of the things I'm really trying to work on in my own self-love journey is for such a long time, I always wanted to prove how smart I was and prove that I was worldly. And so now that I feel like genuinely feel like I proved that, I feel much more confident when somebody says something that I'm like, I actually don't know what that is, of being like, what is, I gave a reaction to divinity school, but I actually don't know what that is. So can you please share?
I'm getting more and more comfortable with that myself. Like, and I was in that situation last year where I was completely overwhelmed and learning all these new things. And I got comfortable saying, yep, I don't know what that is. Please, can somebody explain it to me? Divinity school, the program I did is about the study of religion. Well, I was also able to take classes in like racial capitalism, for instance, with these two amazing professors who just changed my mind. I took a African-American literature course, which was beautiful. And I took a course on like Toni Morrison, where we just read Toni Morrison and Gabriel Garcia Marquez all term. And I'm doing a fellowship with this center called the Hutchins Center, which is a center on African-American research. And so I'm gonna develop a film project there, you know, with their, under their guidance and stewardship. And also I'll get a chance to audit some more classes so I can keep scratching that this nerdy itch that I've got.
Oh my gosh, that's so fascinating. I'm so happy for you. I'm really happy to hear that. And I'm trying to figure out a way to ask this question. But if you took yourself back to that fourth grade moment and that hateful letter that was sent back to you, how would you process that today? I mean, there's a practice that people do, which I'm not sure if you practice, but of reparenting yourself or holding your inner child and parenting your inner child. And have you ever reflected before on how you would have parented yourself in that moment if you had the opportunity, knowing what you know now?
Yeah, I think that I would have said, I would have patted my younger self on the back and said, man, I'm proud of you for expressing how you felt and for putting it out there. And I also would have said that, you know, what she said is obviously not true about you. And And I would have encouraged myself to keep feeling the things that I feel and to keep on saying, you know, expressing myself honestly. And I probably would have taken myself out for some French toast, you know. And just not let it become a bigger thing, but just, you know, talk about it and let it pass. I think that's what I would have done.
I hope you get some French toast this morning. And
I see them right now.
I love that. I love that for you.
Thank you to Andre Holland for his vulnerability and valuable lessons. To learn how you can watch the magnificent film he is starring in, Love Brooklyn, go to their Instagram page at Love Brooklyn Movie. And while you're there, follow at Andre Holland. Want links? Hit the info box. Okay, up next, we're going into the lovers community to discuss our appreciation for Andre, plus some cornerstone memories of our own that we wanted to unpack together. To join discussions like this live, go to loversbyshan.com/community. Were there any reflections or ahas you had from listening to Andre speak that you wanted to share?
It was beautiful. We rarely get to see a glimpse inside of like a male's mind in that form of view, especially the story that he told. I had tears in my eyes.
The way that it was a roller coaster of emotions, and I did not realize that he was going to end that way, I was so shocked. And it makes me think about my nieces and nephews who are 6, 7, and 8 right now, and how things that are happening in their lives at this moment are things that they might remember when they're 30, 40, 50. And it just makes me think about how careful you have to be even when kids are under the age of 10.
So that's what I want to talk about with all of you today, and just reflecting on what have been your memories that you've looked back on and said, oh yeah, I can totally get how that thing, which taught me this thing, became a lesson that I actually carried forward, even when it didn't logically make sense. And I'll share my cornerstone memory, and that is when I was 6 or 7 years old, kind of to your point, Bridget, I just remember knowing that not liking my dad made my mom happy. And my parents were together and they had a good relationship. And maybe it was even a joking thing they had between them. But when my sister was born, she just really gravitated towards my dad. So my mom said that when I was in her stomach, she pointed at her stomach and said, "This one's mine." So I just kind of learned it pleased my mom when I distanced myself from my dad. But I remember being 6 or 7 years old, and we were on this vacation together. It was my entire family, so cousins at all. And we were on this boat, so it was like a moment. And my aunts, who were my dad's sisters, were like, you know, Brian, come have Shannon sit on your lap. You guys take a photo together. Like, come on, come on. And so they're corralling us together. But I'm like, ugh, I don't want to take a picture of my dad. Like, ugh, I don't like my dad. And so I was like, kind of like giving him the cold shoulder. And then my dad says super loud for everyone to hear. He was just like, ugh. Don't worry about Shannon, whatever. She's the kind of person that you can't be too nice to. And that was a message that was repeated kind of quite a bit from my dad, that if he was too nice to me, then I would be mean, or I'm the kind of person who takes people's niceness for granted, so people have to be a little bit rougher or meaner with me. And obviously, as I got older and started entering into romantic relationships, specifically with men, this was sort of a message that I had in my mind that I have to pick somebody who's going to be a little mean to me, or else I'll get bored of them, or I won't like them, or I won't respect them. And it actually wasn't until I met Jared, whom, if you've ever gotten a chance to meet Jared, I would genuinely characterize as one of the nicest people in the world. He's just not the kind of person who's going to talk negatively or talk shit about you. And when I was with him, a part of me was like, I don't know if I'm supposed to do this or I'm built to do this. And then it turns out that I am, that I can be with nice people, and people can be nice to me. And I'm not an inherently, you know, mean person who looks to take advantage of others. So that was a core belief that I had to rewrite through some reflection. But I'll turn it over to all of you if anybody feels compelled to share.
I can go. So my parents aren't together. So Growing up, I was very sensitive. At the time, I didn't have the language for it, but I was a very sensitive kid. I would cry a lot. I would seek a lot of affection and attention from everyone. Parents, friends, kid, everyone. So they developed a narrative with my dad especially that Mariah's annoying. And specifically, I have a memory of just going to my dad at his apartment and like asking for a hug and him being just like, no, stop being annoying, like you're fine. So as I got older, I really, my needs became secondary is what I realized. So my needs took a back burner and I stopped, I translated annoying to like needy. And in my adult life and in my romantic life, I became the cool girl, the girl who didn't need anything and just was having fun. And I remember I met a partner and I kind of jokingly said, well, you know, I'm kind of annoying. He was like, why do you say that? Like, you're not annoying. And it was the first time someone was like, really stopped me in my tracks and was like, you're not annoying.
It makes me think about the concept in the video that we watched about how Shan mentioned, which I thought was so sweet, that I wish someone was there for you to kind of reparent you or walk you through that moment when it happened, the racial incident that he witnessed. But in your case, I guess I don't know how long it took, but years later when you did find a partner, he was supportive and he just kind of stopped the belief, at least with that first stop, like, hey, stop, you're not annoying.
And I give my dad some grace because I was a little kid and little kids can be annoying. It just festered and didn't even realize it until years later. And even in that moment when my partner was like, you're not annoying, it didn't click until after the unpacking of like, oh, that's where that comes from.
Let's see, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, yes, I have one. I think growing up where, but I'm usually in the corner with the book somewhere, all my friends that, you know, were partnered up, and especially growing up, like junior high even, well, I guess elementary even, you know, I had friends like, oh, I know this guy likes me, or that girl likes me, but it didn't happen for me.
Do you think that there was a time where when you feel shiny, I'm trying to be careful of my words here too, though, because in acknowledgement that there are some people who just win the lottery in terms of what is societally favorable at the time. And so it's just much easier to date and present in the world because there's already a billion-dollar marketing campaign that positions that person as attractive and worthy of attention. And that has nothing to do with how much you smile, how kind you are. It's just literally luck of the draw. And the standard of beauty isn't even just shift with time. It shifts by location, right? Not just city to city, but of course, country to country. So what I'm going to say is, though, there is an element that is in your control of just expecting to be looked at. And that's a harder thing to have when you're a part of a society that, again, is not conditioned to look at you. But do you think that there was a particular experience in which you had that told you that you're not shiny? I say shiny in air quotes because shiny things expect to be seen, right? Like if I am a shiny piece of tinfoil, or, you know, you flash a light or a snare to get people's attention. So things that are shiny expect to be looked at. So they enter into the world like, I am going to be looked at. Did you have an experience that told you that you're not shiny? So then from that point going forward, you just entered into every room assuming that you weren't going to be visible.
Yes, yes, yes. Very much yes. So in fourth grade, we moved from Texas to California, and I was the only brown skin person the whole time, like from fourth grade to senior year. Then I went to college and like just felt awkward, even though like I kind of switched the other extreme and had just black and brown friends, but I still was just like kind of already in the homegirl role, I guess. So I just kind of kept doing that, kind of still do that. But yeah, definitely that would be that whole moment of elementary through high school.
Definitely. I 100% agree with you. I was going to say the same thing. Mine goes back to high school. And I was the only Asian among my friends, my circle of friends, and they all had boyfriends. So in my mind, I thought, do boys not like me because I'm yes. the only Asian one? And that stuck for a long time and turned into the urge of wanting to be needed, which goes back to my story. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting to hear that you've had that similar experience.
I just want to repeat to all of you, like, how grateful I am to be in community with a group of hot, cool, smart, thoughtful people who are willing to give me the time of day. Like, it actually blows my mind that any of you show up anytime that I do these. So to have a room full of people who I get to intimately know, and then now I get to connect the dots a bit more on who you are, is just such a privilege that I'm so grateful for. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Okay, so out of respect for the more sensitive cornerstone memories shared, we're going to end the public video here. That doesn't mean the discussions and reflections have to end. What is one of your cornerstone memories? What core belief did it create? And if need be, how are you correcting that belief today? Also, don't forget to check out loversbyshan.com to sign up for the newsletter, get access to quizzes and resources, and of course, to join our community.